You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
This week, the government announced which 11 projects will be fast-tracked through the consent process. The justification for rushing builds for these infrastructures has been the necessity to find a stimulus for the current recession. Now, I wanted to learn about the importance of stimulus for economic recovery. Of course, everything in politics is a balance, and no one's negating the necessity of economic recovery. But do these fast-track consents act as effective stimulus? I asked Rod Orimall about this and what ventures act most effectively as economic stimulus historically and in his opinion. I learned about stimulus and as helping to recover economic downturn in an Economics 101 paper a couple of years ago. So I was wondering if we could have a little bit of a refresh together about what the theory behind that is.
Yes, absolutely. Well, my view is very straightforward. That's a very poor excuse for doing this, because it's going to create only an estimated 1,250 or so jobs, which is a very, very minor stimulus, if any, compared with the greater picture of stimulus that's flowing into the economy in various ways. Mm. And so the idea that this is economically valuable to have these particular projects go that much faster, I just don't think stands up to scrutiny.
What kind of other ventures do we historically take on for stimulus, and should we be looking at considerably different options now, given that we're in this sort of new landscape?
The stimulus can obviously come in all kinds of forms, and we're seeing some new forms this time around in terms of the very direct cash stimulus to households and to companies with wage subsidy and other support. So that's completely unprecedented. And that makes great sense because that puts the money exactly where it's needed. The idea, though, that somehow doing lots of infrastructure is a great stimulus, I think is a far more marginal construct, because there was already a fair amount of construction going on, which has now resumed. Mm. And one of the questions hanging over, could we do more infrastructure, is just who would be doing those jobs. That then begs the question, is we're getting people unemployed from other sectors who could be retrained, but that's all a process that takes time, which then argues against the question that this is a stimulus, or the incitement that now this is stimulus we got to use now.
Right. Wow, that's really interesting. And so, obviously, it is always a balance. I wanted to ask about whether or not this is a failure to balance the importance of both the necessity of a stimulus, but also keeping intact processes that involve public consultation within the RMA. So there is speculation that possibly this is a utilisation of COVID-19 as an opportunity to get those 11 major projects through. What do you sort of make of that criticism?
The first of all, the 11 projects themselves are worthy, and some of them have been around a really, really long time. So the cycle path from West Haven in Auckland to Akaranga on the North Shore is the Sky Path, which has been mooted, planned, debated for years, and now apparently it's suddenly going to happen. Similarly, the electrification of the line from railway line from Papakura to Pukekohe, that's a good thing to do, and construct three rail platforms, particularly at Drury, where there's a lot of house building going on. That's a good thing to do too, but it's not clear why speed is of the essence, which seems to be the driving rationale for all this. These are things that have been long in the, many of these have been long planned and will be built, and therefore suddenly doing them at speed with this very substantial change in process doesn't feel at all valid to me. Mm. But furthermore, if there were legitimately projects that should be done at speed for reason that there's a failed piece of infrastructure that needs to be replaced very rapidly, I'm thinking of the terrible sewage problems that Wellington's got, for example. And then there are other mechanisms. So, for example, the Environmental Defence Society very helpfully suggested or recommended that if there is going to be fast track, then it would still be possible for interested parties to send a written submission to the panel judging that fast track process. And so they at least have that evidence in front of them. So it's not as good as having people then coming to give evidence, but at least it is giving a way for those voices to be heard and for the panel to take that into consideration too. And I don't think that a very straightforward mechanism like that would slow up the decision-making process, you know, other than by a day or two whilst the panel considered those particular written submissions.
The question that still lies is, why can't the existing system be used to produce robust consent without the need to take the process out of the hands of council or without specifically preventing public input? How worried should we be about these concerns?
I still believe that when we get, hopefully in the next term of Parliament, some very substantial change to our regulatory system on these issues. And here I'm very much a fan not of constantly tweaking the RMA, but actually stepping back and having a real first principles look at it, which is exactly what the Environmental Defence Society, along with the Property Council and some other business organisations alongside EDS, have done in their ongoing RMA reform project, which is full of terrific insight and tremendous recommendations. So I'm still confident that as we go through that process, the ability for the public at large and, of course, interested parties in particular to have a say in this will be maintained. Mm. And if there's the faintest suggestion otherwise, we should all fight very strongly to make sure that that principle is upheld. So I am confident about that longer-term process, which is why I think this fast track now is a bit daft, really. It's a process for a handful of projects for 1,250 jobs that on projects that were going to be built anyway. Some have been hanging around a long time. A lot of effort's gone into this, and it's hard to see what the value of doing so is.
Mm. How much do we need to utilise opportunities for other stimulus over the next couple of months? How much do we know the government has in store for, like you say, things that aren't just concerned with infrastructure?
Very much the case, and that gets a little harder to work out what those new kinds of stimulus need to be. But for example, if we first of all stick just with infrastructure, there needs to be a far stronger lens on all these investments as what's future-proofing the country, right, and particularly from a climate change mitigation point of view and adaptation point of view. Adapting to rising sea levels and mitigation, reducing emissions. We are very weak on that in New Zealand. Some countries are tracking better on that than we are. The EU, for example, is proposing a 750 billion euro program. Still has to be agreed and signed off by all the member parliaments to have that kind of green recovery focus. And some other countries are doing better than others on that. But we are really weak on that. Mm. In announcing these 11, the government is saying, there's two cycleways in there. That's good. That's part of all that. Electrifying rail, that's part of all that. And it is, well, yes, it is. This is really messing around on the edges, on the outer fringe of the issues we need to be dealing with.
Yeah. Well, time will only tell if we're going to have a principles-based RMA and also incorporate provisions against climate change more effectively, hey?
Yes, that's the big thing to push for, because the RMA is a fine piece of legislation in many ways. The very big sort of reform that this working group has been looking at over recent years and working very hard still retains a lot of the essential principles of the RMA. It's not throwing the whole thing out and starting all over again, but it's making it now more than 30 years after it was first introduced, making that legislation really, really appropriate for the sort of issues we face today, and also needing to deal with confidence and clarity with all these pressing issues. So the time frame on all these things is getting far more compressed compared with where we were 30 years ago. And and crucially, the interdependence of issues. So, for example, how so many factors create additional push on climate change, and then when that climate change happens, it has far more knock-on effects. So there's this great interdependence of issues that we've been very poor with dealing with in the past, and we need to get really good at doing.
Every time in terms of this government recognising that these, I'm talking more generally now, but they recognise all of these problems and tell us that they hear us and believe us and see these to be issues. But the reform over the last term doesn't necessarily reflect any inclination to change it, which is funny when you think about the let's do this rhetoric of before this term started. To finish, do you want to tell us a bit about how much you think this is another example of that, or how if that concerns you that this government has sort of fallen into that pattern of behaviour a lot?
Yes, I think that's exactly an accurate and appropriate description of what's going on here. And these things are always complicated, but I think there are two very pertinent factors. The first one is there are a number of ministers who don't have prior government experience, and that's not unusual. It's not a disqualification from office, but it does require a strong collegial effort to make the most of the talent you've got and to develop the talent you've got. And some ministers are doing fine, others not. But I think the far more important one is the very corrosive effect that New Zealand First has on the coalition, because you have very talented young ministers such as Julianne Jenter in transport, Associate Minister of Transport. So she came up doing a lot of work with officials and industry and everybody else on a very comprehensive policy program to get us into low emission and electric vehicles over coming decades. And New Zealand finally having a fuel efficiency standard on our vehicles, with the only OECD country that doesn't, by 2025. So in that sense, it's hardly groundbreaking, but we don't have that. But New Zealand First killed that, and on completely, completely false grounds, that the fee rebate system that would incentivize that would be an undue burden to people in rural communities. That's not the case. The fee rebate scheme would benefit people of lower incomes, and all the data was in the policy documents, if anybody cared to read it, about how lower income people and the sort of cars they bought would benefit the most. And so complete nonsense. And so at every turn, New Zealand First, Winston Peters' attitude is the government, you know, the Labour Party should thank us because we've made it possible for them to be in power. And that's technically correct. There's a few votes that put them over the top. But a party which is only polling about 2 or 3% currently should not have such an enormous veto power over the party that represents 10 times or 15 times that poor part of the population. And every time Shane Jones and Winston Peters say ridiculous things which absolutely do not align with the facts at all, and they're doing it only for their their personal political ambitions to cling on to power. Every time they do that, that must be amazingly discouraging to those ministers in the government that are actually trying to do things. So I think Peters and Jones in particular, there are actually some good people in New Zealand First, but Jones and Peters in particular, and they are the leader and the deputy leader after all, are astonishingly corrosive. Mm. And I would hope that when we get to the election in September, people will have a good think about that.
Around, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
That was Rod Oram. Notice when we were talking about the Resource Management Act, Rod referred to it as a fine piece of legislation, which is interesting because we're now hearing from a representative from Te Ara Whātū, an organisation that fights for climate justice, an issue that they say impacts Indigenous populations considerably. I asked India Logan Riley about their perception of the RMA and why the fast-tracked process exacerbates breaches of Te Tiriti o Waitangi. The RMA is, one could argue, itself a colonial presence. Do you want to touch on what your organisation's impression of the decision to fast-track these process was, to and the extent to which you feel it breaches Te Tiriti, and whether or not that was already happening under the RMA, and how worried you are that this is an acceleration of that issue?
The RMA itself does not reflect or accurately uphold Te Tiriti or Waitangi. Mm. In fact, the principles that it references in and of itself is not Te Tiriti itself. The principles were kind of government-fashioned ideas that they pulled out of Te Tiriti, but it isn't Te Tiriti itself. Mm. So, yeah, many of us have been keeping an eye on the RMA and this fast-track process, and we're really concerned because we're seeing a step away from upholding Te Tiriti rather than moving towards it. Mm. And in a legislative structure where the breaches of Te Tiriti were already locked in by government law, it's definitely a backward step. And even though they're looking at ending the amendment in 2 years' time, in a space when there's going to be a lot of money going into new infrastructure and new projects, it's very concerning that they're willing to kind of overlook Te Tiriti all over again.
Yeah, particularly because, and look, I've been having this conversation with so many different people this morning, especially because of Andrew Little's comments at the Black Lives Matter march on Monday, when he said change needs to come from all of government. Of course, many Māori advocates have been saying, well, if it needs to come from all of government, why haven't any of those changes started under your government? Does it seem to your organisation, Te Ara Whātū, that these colonial measures will be accelerated?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're seeing here is an outcome of successive governments being completely unwilling to face the racism that's embedded in their legislation. Mm. And we're seeing that repeated all over again with this particular government. Is just, we can see it's there, but we're not going to do anything about it. And we saw that with the last Labor government as well, some extreme breaches of Indigenous rights principles, ones where the UN actually started to look very seriously at what the previous Labor government was doing, and I think this particular government is continuing that legacy by rushing through this fast-track process, by its refusal to do anything about the theft of Māori children by the state, the whole conflict around Ihu Mātou, and refusing to step in and be a leader in that space. Mm. It's really weak of them, and it's really disappointing because we hear their words but we don't actually see any follow through.
Mm. What does this mean for the patterns of advocacy for your group? Where do you envision this movement might go next?
Yeah, well, I think I definitely want to acknowledge that racism in Aotearoa was born hundreds of years ago, and it's been something that Māori have been resisting for generations and generations, and we will continue to do that work because we have to. We have, you know, like a kaitiaki responsibility to demand better for our communities and for local communities.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a continuation of the work, and it's I think it's really important to acknowledge the ways in which racism is being pushed back on around the world, and in the context of that, to see the government creating a fast-track process in the IMA that accelerates or enables further racism and harm of Māori communities and harm of local communities is really appalling, and it's really sensitive to the changes that are being asked of us, to the changes that are being asked of colonial governments to make. Yeah.
An OIA request to David Parker's office has shown that efforts that treat Māori as a lobby group did not deliver on Māori consultation for this bill as promised. Do you know about the nitty-gritty of what that inclusion looks like and where the failure was?
Yeah, so I know that they consulted with the iwi chair's leader group, and what they've basically come up with, or what David Parker's office has come up with, is that the proposed projects will go to an expert group. And the expert group is mandated to have iwi representation, but in nowhere is it embedded that it needs to be co-governed or it needs to have local iwi representation and that kind of thing. And the expert group can invite stakeholders to give advice on the projects, but what it really misses is that so much of our Indigenous knowledge, so much of our Māori knowledge when it comes to our local environment is held by the local community. And so that expert group may not necessarily be able to understand the full dynamics of what's happening when they're looking at a project,
yeah.
You know, how it's going to impact on the ground, environmentally, how it's going to impact trying to address climate change. And we saw this happen actually last year with the cycleway in Kaikoura, where they started building it, and the local iwi were like, you shouldn't be doing this, it's building on our wahi tapu, it's building on our urupa, it's building on our wahi tonga. And they ended up actually having to stop the project partway through because they hadn't even bothered to listen in the first place to those concerns or make space for those concerns. And that kind of thing can be addressed and prevented very easily through a co-governance model.
Mm.
And what they're doing is they're fast-tracking projects that actually do, will have, what they're doing is they're fast-tracking projects that contain more possibility to do harm than good because they're embedding these paternalistic colonial structures.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Yeah.
That was India Logan Riley. Grizzy texted in saying, a freaking men to that Rod about what Rod Oram said about New Zealand First. Thanks for texting in, Grizzy. It's nice to hear from you again. It's interesting hearing that against what India was just saying about colonial legacies among all of these governments. Definitely some food for thought there. Now, in the final installment of this package about the fast-track consents, I spoke to Generation Zero about this possibly being a missed opportunity to implement climate obligations that this government already committed to. Let's hear more.
Generation Zero's position is that having public participation is always a good thing, and it's something that we always encourage because building a consensus around projects that specifically are going to be in people's backyards, mm. You know, making sure that local people do have a bit of a say in, you know, what is actually going to be happening around them is super important. Not only to make sure it's a robust decision-making process, but also to give opportunity for people to say, hey, this is something that you could change to this project that would like mitigate the adverse effects on me and my community, and there is no opportunity for that to come through.
Mm. How much does Generation Zero care about the specificity of each project, and will you guys partake in advocacy to prevent those projects going forward, or is that not precisely what the concern is here?
I think you're right, and in that there are certain projects that we definitely do have concerns about. We do look at the list and we think most of them are really good. There are cycleways in their walkways, electrification of rail, a lot of papakāinga development, and we would support those projects. There is a roading project in there, the Papakārīta Turi improvement.
Mm.
And, you know, I guess it's not building a new road, which is good, but also not exactly something that we would necessarily advocate for being
for sure.
on the list.
For sure.
And I think there has been a lot of concern around the water storage reservoir. Just, I think, because there are so many adverse effects and there's no process to, you know, make sure that those adverse effects are mitigated apart from an expert consenting panel.
Mm.
And we're not entirely sure that those adverse effects can be mitigated.
Mm.
You know, it is an absolute missed opportunity that a climate assessment wasn't made of this piece of legislation.
Mm.
I think last year the government did make a commitment that all legislation would have a climate impact assessment on it, and the fact that this one doesn't is quite disappointing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. A key concern out of this is that by compromising the ability of the public to have input is another breach of Te Tiriti o Waitangi. And I found it interesting from the get-go that the term non-controversial was used about shovel-ready projects. What do you make of the semiotics of the idea of some projects being non-controversial, particularly in the context of occupation of land in Aotearoa being a breach of Te Tiriti when it's not done with iwi consent?
Yeah, and I think, so Generation Zero's position is that the government definitely needs to step up on actually honouring and upholding Te Tiriti o Waitangi, that it's not okay anymore just to have a provision in a piece of legislation saying, well, honour the principles of the treaty,
yeah,
that you do need to work in partnership and collaborate, not just consult, but collaborate with iwi and hapu on what is going on around us. And, yeah, there are significant concerns on Generation Zero's behalf that we are going to breach the Treaty of Waitangi with this piece of legislation,
mm,
and that projects are going to be put through against iwi wishes, and that there are no real appeal rights apart from on points of law for them, and that's quite concerning to us.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
That was Jen Cotum of Generation Zero. Really interesting things there. I'm going to keep covering this issue because it does sound like we need to have our guard up and stop this continuing if it does, as everyone touched on, go against iwi and hapu. We'll be back after these messages.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.